Good morning, no, good afternoon, and welcome to the Sunday special where the hosts of the podcast On The Shack come together to talk about the week that was. I'm Vicky from Policed, and I'm joined by Tony and Martin from the Echo Chamber podcast. We're delighted to have Tomás Ryan from the ASG and John Nihulo, an activist and friend to the Shack, join us today. As ever, this is live for Patreons, so throw your questions and your comments into the chat and we'll get to as many as we can. Tomás, we wanted to talk to you about the opening up process, what's going on. So what's in your head about this at the moment?
Well, I'm quite concerned. There's a lot of confusion at the moment with respect to where we are in Ireland. Start by saying the vaccine program has been and is a success, not just the vaccines themselves, but the government rollout of the vaccine in Ireland is going quite well. And in Ireland, we have wonderful take up of the vaccine, which I think is a really important point to make. And we're going to really see the benefits of that as we move through this. You take, for example, Israel has been one of the most successful countries in the world. But their take-up started to peter out after they got to 60%. And similar problems are going to be faced even in places like Australia, New Zealand, where up to one-third of people don't want to be vaccinated. Now, we're not going to have that particular problem. Combine that with us being an island. If we play our cards well, we could come out of this in a very, very good situation by international standards. But right now, the problem is the reopening. Is it going too quickly? Are we going to be able to maintain it over the summer? And are there good expectations? And the main issue for us right now can be boiled down to the Delta variant, the variant that arose in India. It is in Ireland. We don't really know to what levels, but it's here and it's growing. As we relax restrictions, it's going to spread more easily. And it's going to come over from Great Britain because it's now dominant in Great Britain. We've limited travel from India, but not sufficiently from Great Britain itself. And despite the fact that over 40% of people in the UK are fully vaccinated, and that includes children in that 40%, I mean, of the whole population, not just the adult population, we're seeing exponentially rising cases, significantly rising hospitalizations, particularly in certain areas of England. And we know this variant is 2.5 times more likely to put you in hospital. We know it's far more transmissible than the British B117 Kent variant, which is dominant in Ireland. So it can take over here. And it also has significant vaccine escape. It doesn't make the vaccines ineffective. The vaccines are wonderful, but it's chipping away at the vaccine. Every variant is chipping away at the vaccine to the point where now we really need the second dose to have significant efficacy. When you put all this together, we have a situation whereby we have to make a choice. And if we're serious, if the government is serious about reopening, then it should be doing everything to reduce travel from Great Britain. And I would argue from much of Europe, because unfortunately, the tourism in Southern Europe is going to be a way of seeding the country, as we did with the Spanish variant last summer. So that's the main concern right now, a race against vaccines and the Delta variant. I'm very concerned also about indoor dining opening. We don't know whether it will be okay or not. I think we're even without the Delta variant, we're sort of sailing very close to the wind. But I think it's really important to say that people who are not vaccinated need to look after themselves as individuals. So from my perspective, as a population, it's almost a coin toss as to whether this is going to go bad this summer. That's without the Delta variant taking over. But as an individual, it's a different story. If you have not been vaccinated yet, you have to ask yourself, How do you want to partake in activities until you are safe? Because this, if you're not vaccinated, this is the most dangerous time in the pandemic in Ireland for you. Remember, we went into our second lockdown when we hit that threshold of 300 cases a day. That's when we knew we were in trouble. Well, now we're about 400, 450 cases a day. And the government have admitted, based on NPHET modeling, that in the best case scenario, we're going to go up to about 600, 700 cases a day. Thus they hope that the vulnerable are protected mostly. That's true, but you may not be protected. So I'm going to be very cautious as a relatively young man who has not been vaccinated. It's still not clear to me when I will be vaccinated, but I'll be very cautious about what indoor activities I partake in until after I've gotten my second dose of whatever vaccine I end up getting.
Thomas, I read yesterday that with the Delta variant in the UK, there have been 48 deaths. Of those deaths, the majority were people who hadn't any vaccination. Those who had one vaccination didn't have any real extra protection. But those who had two jabs, there was still 30% of the deaths came from that cohort. Plus, the amount of people going into hospital is younger, unvaccinated people.
Yes. Yeah. So, Martin, that's true. And I found it alarming. But let's put some qualifiers on that. I find it alarming based on, you know, trying to be act as somewhat of a canary as much as I can. And looking down the line, it's not alarming with a big A. It's true that 20% of people, 20 to 30% of people in that Public Health England report were fully vaccinated and died of the Delta variant. So it's still a small overall sample. It's likely that those people who died of it had underlying conditions, which makes the vaccines less effective of you in general.
So, no vaccine is ever 100%.
Exactly. And so these kind of situations, they highlight the risks to the individual. And my colleague in ISAC, Professor Anthony Staines, he's highly vulnerable. And he knows well that even though he's fully vaccinated, he's still quite vulnerable as an individual because of his pre-existing health conditions. And he won't be fully safe until the community around him is safe. We need to recognize that. But that's about risk to individuals. The risk to surges are what we're really concerned with, the risk to the population, because that's where everything gets out of control. And that's where, if we don't manage it correctly, we get lockdowns. And we hate lockdowns. The point is to avoid lockdowns too.
If Delta is an extra risk to people who have underlying conditions, then I would say that cohort 7 needs to be looked after way better than it has been, because as I know you've praised the vaccination system and it's been great, but cohort 7, I have friends of mine who do have underlying conditions who should have had their vaccine by now and they haven't, and there seems to be a fall down that they're not doing cohort 7 in the large vaccination centres. We don't have vaccination centres across the country, and there are lots of doctors, due to the fact that their offices are too small or don't have enough ventilation, and the GPs are not offering vaccinations full stop, and they're not doing their cohort 7 patients, and there's no pathway to care, there's no how to refer to another doctor who will do it. One of my own partners falls under that category, and it took 4 weeks of ringing around, and his doctor and him ringing around various practices in Dublin to find someone who could vaccinate them. And that's a lot of paperwork, a lot of body of work, that it just, the systems aren't there.
And can I just add that, because I'm cohort 7, registered on the 12th of April. I actually got my first dose yesterday on the age basis, being in my early 40s, but I didn't even think of that as an option of ringing around. Like, that never even occurred to me at all.
But your doctor, if they're not doing it, should go, okay, I'm not doing it.
Nothing.
What's the policies and procedures? What did the HAC say we should do? Who do we ring? Mm-hmm. It's not there.
Yeah.
I can I just say, I haven't been vaccinated and I'm really angry. That's just because the idea that you got vaccinated before me, Vicky, is just criminal. But sorry.
You're so much older than me.
And more important, let's be honest.
Well, I fell under cohort 7 because I'm dealing with long COVID. And if somebody's been out of work for the last 9 months, and it's like, my battery was 100% before COVID. And then when I got COVID, it was like my turn on battery was down to 25. I'm up to about 60% now, but I still have days where I get fatigued and the brain fog is bad and I really can't do anything. And my concern is that long COVID, or as they're calling it, post-acute COVID syndrome, tends to affect people under 35. I'm 45. I'm not in that category. But the under 35s who are not vaccinated, who we get this more infectious Delta variant comes in, we're looking at having, currently they're saying it's 1 in 7 who get COVID. go on to develop post-acute COVID syndrome. But the concern is they're the people who aren't vaccinated. They're the people most likely to get this long COVID and fatigue. They're people who've got the rest of their lives ahead of them. They're the people most likely to work in hospitality and work in restaurants. They're the people that we've seen all the employers coming out saying, can we cut pop? We need our employees back. And I'm like, if I was 25 and was looking at all of the data out there and not knowing when I'm going to get a vaccine and being told I need to come back into an ill-ventilated pub or restaurant to serve people who are over 45, who have money, who are bored and vaccinated, I'd be thinking long and hard for it. I'm really concerned. Again, we don't have the pathway to care. There are no procedures for GPs. There's no procedures that if you get long COVID, what happens? There are very few long COVID centres. I have an appointment for my first long COVID review, which is happening 10 months after I got long COVID. We have counties that don't have a referral place for long COVID. And people have been told, sorry, there's not one in the county. We're not referring you anywhere else. Too bad. Mm-hmm. Or we've got doctors not knowing what to expect with long COVID and trying to pigeonhole people into different categories of, well, this looks like lupus, or does anyone in your family have fibromyalgia, or does anyone in your family have ME? Because that's what they associate the symptoms with. Because COVID and long COVID seems to jam the keep going button in the immune system and keeps all the autoimmune going. So it seems to be related to autoimmune diseases. So looking down the barrel of chronic fatigue, autoimmune, not knowing when your health is going to recover, and you've got the vintners and the restaurants out there saying, come back and work, when we don't have the vaccines rolled out, I'm really concerned we're looking for a health crisis in regards to post-acute COVID syndrome.
Absolutely. Long COVID is no joke. It is a real thing. In the first wave, I was aware of it anecdotally because so many people my age in the United States were experiencing it. But there was no scientific data on it. And then we were told it wasn't a real thing. Don't worry about it. You still see prominent voices in the Irish media saying things like, there's a school of thought that long COVID isn't really a real thing.
Have you tried antidepressants?
But we know that 1 in 9 people, the most conservative studies say 1 in 9 people who get COVID-19 will experience long COVID. 1 in 3 people, if you've got any kind of a pre-existing condition on average. And this is irrespective of your age. In the United Kingdom, 1 million people have reported long COVID symptoms lasting more than 3 months, and nearly 500,000 people have reported long COVID symptoms lasting more than 12 months. So that's what we're dealing with. We don't really know what the long-term effects are, including on people who are under 18. The vaccine efficacy is the other point Janet made, which I think is really important. It's never perfect. AstraZeneca was 70% before the Indian variant. Now it's 60% after two doses with the Indian variant. And that doesn't stay forever. After 6 months, you're down. You know, your immunity goes down after 6 months and down further by 9 months. And we're still learning what that is. So we're always going to be playing catch up. And we need to be using vaccines as one tool to get case numbers down. And look at other countries. So Israel, Chile, the United Kingdom, Canada, they're all more or less in the same degree of vaccination, but they all have incredibly different experiences. We want the Israeli experience or better. And their key is they didn't just rely on vaccination. They created an environment where vaccination was more likely to be effective.
I think that's a really interesting point, that where I think a lot of people are very fixated on the hospital numbers, but that actually that's only a very immediate assessment of things. And there are issues like long COVID. And I know you joked there about antidepressants, but actually there's quite a bit of data coming out of psychiatric illness following COVID and other conditions following COVID as well, isn't there?
I'm in the long COVID group on Facebook. If anybody is a long COVID Ireland, so if anybody's been dealing with this and wants to talk to other people about their experiences, the support is there. But you've also got the fact that I was never hospitalised. I was sent to A&E 3 times. Mm-hmm. I was treated in A&E and I was sent home. And then I was so concerned with what was happening with my heart and tachycardia, because there is heart conditions in the family. I was very lucky to go private and get a health checkup on my heart, because I would walk the top of the stairs and my heart rate would shoot to 130. You know, that's what Tony does. He's running around with a t-shirt on. Just from walking up the stairs. But there's also the fact that the schools are still open. And we've got SNA, some of which are who, and teachers, some of which are cohort seven, who have not yet been vaccinated dealing with kids.
These points are in the, can I just say there's been two points made, excellent points by both Jana and Linda about the exposure to SNAs and teachers and how they don't have they don't have an alternative in this. And some of the SNAs and some of the teachers who are out with long COVID for quite a while, which, you know, and we've seen that also when we talked about the level of healthcare workers who were impacted by it and how, you know, that was where the highest infection rates were. I think it's great that Jan, you happen to be here when Tomas is on, because, you know, you're a brilliant advocate for people with long COVID. But I do think there's also a mentality now. Everybody, you know, the weather is good, Tomas, and we're taking pictures of Capel Street, and we're being encouraged to have an outdoor summer. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. I don't know if it's going back in.
I think outdoors is okay. If you're socializing outdoors, we know this is an airborne disease. The more you're in a ventilated situation, the better you are. Now, outdoors does not mean a tent. If there's a roof over your head, yeah, it's not really outdoors. Outdoors means outdoors. And avoid really densely packed crowds. What we saw last week in South William Street was unfortunate, bad public management, of course. But if you're in someone's face or if you're too close together, you're going to be at risk. If you can smell cigarette smoke, if you can smell aftershave, you know you're roughly in risk. If you can't...
Or you're standing too close to Martin.
So that's the kind of way to think about it. So outdoors, I'm not too worried. And the ISAG view, informed by a lot of scholarly work that's been done on COVID-19 and ventilation, what we've learned from other countries. And I have to say, the outstanding advocacy in Ireland that has been done by Dr. Orla Hegarty, who's not an ISAG member, but who is doing similar work, I suppose, to what ISAG are trying to do, but really focused on the issue of ventilation, tells us that we can have a relatively safe outdoor summer. It's not zero risk, but it's much more appropriate than indoors. I myself have socialized in the last couple of weeks outdoors in parks with friends in a distanced manner, all the precautions that you would expect. It's not something that I think we should be discouraging, particularly since the government have made the decision to open up. I'm not saying it doesn't make a difference. If you were having a goal to bring cases down to zero, for example, over a set amount of time, it would contribute, and you probably would say, okay, we're going to have a focus to really reduce transmission.
You did say about personal responsibility, but it's also community responsibility. I'm vaccinated, right? So, but the thing is, I can still catch a variant. I could catch Delta. I could catch COVID again, because it's possible to catch COVID again. And while I should not get sick again, I can still transmit that. So I'm very aware that my son and daughter are in their early 20s. So my son is like, I'm 23. I'll probably be back. I might get vaccinated before Christmas. So I'm very aware that any risk I take, I might bring that home to them. And heaven forbid they get long COVID, or heaven forbid it is still transmittable. And while it's great to say you're looking after your own risk, I think we still need to have that, as we said, the metal, the work, the minding each other, the minding the people in other people's lives by limiting the risks.
And now I really enjoying this conversation. I could keep going here for ages, but I do have to move us on. And I'm going to move us on to the mother and baby home.
You know, can I make one quick point? Jana did make the point on the medical apartheid, because Tomas, you mentioned Israel a couple of times. I think it's important, just to let you know, Hannah was registered. They're having difficulty with it, but we will be talking to her during the week. But she tells me that vaccines have started to be rolled out, but obviously not in association with the Israeli state and some of the practices that are going on there. They seem to have received a batch of vaccines from Qatar. So we will touch on it hopefully during the week, and we'll bring you a more nuanced and actual view from on the ground on that, Jana. But you're right, there's a huge discrepancy there. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to move us on to the mother and baby homes.
Can I just interject there, Martin, and say,
go ahead.
I'm refusing to call them homes. They are not homes. Yeah. They were institutions. People were institutionalized. They were kept there. They were restricted there. They had their rights removed. So I won't call them a home, because a home is a place where you can relax, where you're looked after, hopefully where you're nurtured. And it shouldn't be a stressful place.
They're really institutions.
They're mother and baby institutions. Yeah,
and it's interesting because the Northern Irish report refused to call them homes and referred to them as institutions on that basis.
Yeah, no, it's a very valid, it is a hugely valid point. And we had institutionalized, I think, the highest rate of institutionalization other than Russia, I think, in the world at that time. I think
Seem to think the Magdalen Laundries were terrible, the industrial schools were terrible, the care homes that people put away in terrible, they're all institutions, but the mother and baby homes weren't as bad. No, they were all institutions, all foisted off for the state to be run by the church, where they exploited and abused people.
I think we could fairly call them gulags. And I think that's a fair point to say.
It's where they sent the undesirables.
Yeah. Vicky, can I ask you first, what's your impression of what's been going on this past week?
Well, there's a few things. And just to note, the Journal have a piece this morning where they're reporting on a form that women survivors, victims were asked to complete by the commission, which under a question asking you about your, is it relationship or marital status?
Current relationship.
You know, it includes all of the standard kind of, although I always find it weird, divorced, separated, cohabitating, casual. And then it also includes rape and incest as tick boxes under your relationship status.
That's very strange.
That's strange. It was one of the options. My God, like an option.
No, there are two options, rape, incest, separate options. It is... You would never, under any circumstances, ask a rape victim or survivor about their experiences in a tick box manner. It is beyond unacceptable, and it is so indicative of the disrespect and the lack of trauma-informed approaches to this whole thing. That alone just undermines everything for me.
Undergraduate students... I've seen better ethical and forms and better ethical care. And undergraduate students are taught this in humanities and social science. So I'm absolutely stunned. The state has paid these experts who are meant to be leaders in their field, their PhDs, academics, and this is what they used?
Yeah, methodologically, it is beyond ethically unacceptable. And Mary Daly was asked this at the seminar, why didn't she include a proper methodology? And she effectively said we could have, we just didn't. But that's really not good enough. So we've seen issues this week. Obviously, the commissioners were invited again to attend at the Children's Committee, and a very lengthy and problematic letter from the commissioners explaining why they wouldn't and how they felt that the report had already been destroyed to a point, or maligned publicly to a point, that they weren't going to put themselves in that position. Roderick O'Gorman did announce on Friday that he was bringing proposals to Cabinet in the next week or two to put in place a process to review the report. So it appears like there is going to be some kind of independent review of the report conducted. This is a very mixed situation. It is encouraging to see some acknowledgement that there are problems with the report. But whatever happens has to be done under a very set number of conditions. Claire McGettrick was very good on this on Twitter yesterday. The first thing is that nothing can delay redress. Absolutely nothing. We have women who are dying. You know, we know this. Redress needs to proceed, and it need not be delayed by any process, because the government had already made clear that they were going to go further than what had been recommended anyway. So they've already overstepped that. So that needs to proceed. But whatever review is set up, it needs to not result in delay. It needs to not result in re-traumatization. It needs to listen to women survivors about what they want to happen. It needs not to be just a legalistic tick box of whether this report was okay or not. It really needs to engage with how we're going to remember these experiences in our society and acknowledge what happened in truly effective transitional ways that help us as a society to come to terms with what was done in our name. And it's so important that women and survivors and victims are engaged in this process of designing it. This is what they've done in the North. They've got Phil Scraton and Maeve O'Rourke, two absolute legends in this space, designing the process in consultations with survivors and victims. And that's what we need to do here now. Jan, I don't know, you probably have a million thoughts on this as well.
Have we learned nothing from the Ryan report and the whitewash that was the Magdalen Laundries? This is, so my, for those who have no idea who the hell I am, a reproductive rights activist, activist and agitator. So De Valera's Ireland set up with MacDaid. They said, no contraception, we're not having any of that. But girls were still getting pregnant. And girls got pregnant. Men didn't get them pregnant. Men didn't rape them. Girls got pregnant. And then when somebody was pregnant out of the bands of matrimony and they couldn't be hushed up with a quick wedding on a Tuesday in a blue dress, because that you were disgraced, they were put away. This isn't far distance history. One of my friends, his granddad had to rescue his mother from a laundry. From a mother and baby home. Her father found out she was pregnant. He had refused her engagement to the dad. And then when he found out she was pregnant, he drove across the country and put her in a mother and baby home far away where no one would find her. It took 4 months for her, who is now her husband, and her father-in-law to track her down. And even then, she only had stubble because he'd fallen in love with her in long hair and her hair was completely shaved off in this institution, and she was kept there. And she was not allowed to leave until she was married the next morning at 7 o'clock in the chapel, in the mother and baby home. And then they were allowed to leave. I have friends of mine who are still seeking redress for vaccinations, who have more, instead of the regular 2 or 3 BCG, have more than 12, because they were experimented on in the mother and baby institutions. And they don't have their records either. And, you know, one of the most infamous one was, of course, the one, St. Patrick's, which was in off the Navan Road, and all of their stuff, all of their records went up in flames in a mysterious fire. Mm-hmm. So this is the lived experience, the lived pain, the lived trauma of so many people. And I'm hugely concerned that they're taking so long to do this, like they did with the survivors of symphysiotomy. Everyone that dies is another X amount of money the state doesn't have to pay out. So I'm incredibly concerned about this. Roderick O'Gorman has had this land on him as a new TD and a new minister. He's one of my TDs.
He's a year in post now. He can shake off the newness.
No, what I'm saying is he is new into government. But we need to remember that this report was put in place before then. Yeah. That this report is the part of, let's face it, the institutionalization of people and the abuse of people by the church-run organizations on the behalf has all happened while Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were in government. That's their legacy. They have always been a government. This is what they did.
I think there's an institutional, and reluctance isn't strong enough a word. It's not strong enough a word to describe what they've done with the secret history of Ireland. They're covering it up, but they're doing it in real time, in our faces, and yet there isn't. We haven't reached a tipping point where people have said, "No, we've had enough." Now there is an indication of a tipping point within the polls that came out yesterday. And I think all of this is feeding into an anti-comfortable status quo that doesn't want to look at the past or indeed the problems of the present.
Can I come in on that for a second and just make the point that we spoke to Sean Murray, who is one of the people taking action, legal action against Owen Harris, for example, and other journalists who are related to that. And he made the point that a lot of these people were gatekeepers and it's not in their favour to see the truth come out. And it is endemic in a lot of parts of Irish society that it doesn't suit certain people to have these truths come out. And if anybody has read even just the executive summary of the Mother and Baby Home report, you know that it was on a basis of, you know, it reminded of Enda Kenny's, we all partied, we all did this, therefore there's no, you know, this was the kind of tone to it. And it goes back to this, and to Vicky's first point, that redress cannot be delayed. It cannot be delayed. But it was actually delayed in the executive summary, Vicky. It was.
I'll say two things here. So firstly, I've been really honoured to be involved in a project with Mairead Enright, where over 20 academics have been involved in rewriting the executive summary. And that will be published in the next 10 days or so, I think. And it's wonderful. And we based it on what was in the report. We didn't have access to the confidential reports or anything like that. And it's a really strong statement as to what could have been achieved on the basis of what we know they had. So that'll be a really important read, I think. But I think that this point is, it is a really big point, because this point of the secret history, because once you start going there, where else do you go? I mean, you mentioned Sean Murray, but like all of the Irish behavior during the Troubles, for instance, are we ready to acknowledge that? Are we ready to accept the wrongs that were done? I mean, we talked to Oscar Brannock on Policed and how the state tortured him. Are we ready and willing to accept what was done in our name in all parts of society?
What's still being done in our name in regards to direct provision and asylum seekers? Yeah. Ireland was the very first country to say, you have the right to claim asylum here on LGBT grounds. But yes, they turn around and refuse people asylum, saying, but being gay was illegal back then, so you couldn't have been actively gay with anybody, because nobody had gay sex in Ireland before it was legal.
No.
And they've also turned around and said to a bisexual woman, well, you had the choice to just marry a man and settle down. So you know, we're still having these injustices against people that we don't like, that don't fit in, who aren't respectable.
Yeah.
Who don't fit in with the ideal. And heaven forbid, we would look at those people and choose to live our lives differently. And that's what De Valera did. Anyone who was different, anyone who broke the status quo, anyone that people could have looked at, went, well, they chose something different and they're doing okay, were eradicated and erased. And that's always been the case.
And modern day Fine Gael then claiming success around repeal and equal marriage, you know, it's all part of the same trajectory. Martin, you wanted to come in on the polls there. Talk to us about those.
Yeah, there's a big change, a big shift. Sinn Féin are now 10 points ahead. And whether anybody knows it or not, 10 points is very difficult to draw back. It's really difficult. And I think there's a perception or a feeling that there is a wave now, and that wave is in Sinn Féin's favour. The losers in this are Fine Gael. Fianna Fáil are kind of holding ground, but Fine Gael are losing. Also, People for Profit, and I hate to say it, they have lost an awful lot of ground. And I think that's because they're an activist party and they need to be active, which they can't be.
Did you dig into the report, Martin?
Into which
the B&A attitudes.
Yeah, I looked at the age demographic, which is really interesting stuff.
It shows that Sinn Féin support is even higher in the younger demographics. Absolutely, but it also shows that Dublin is still Fine Gael.
It is, yeah, it is. And,
what's going on with the by election? Given who they chose, given who Fine Gael chose for the by election, and given that they snubbed Kate O'Connell, who was very active in repeal, who stood up and made some very personal statements in the Dáil, and I was like, I find myself rooting for Fine Gael TD. Fine Gael TD? What's going on? To go from her to somebody who left the party to set up Renewa, was anti-repeal. And that's who Simon Harris is on the trail with. And lots of people that I know that had softened towards Fine Gael and went, you know, Simon wasn't so bad, he did a lot for appeal, are now looking at him going, what the hell?
Oh, Jan, you're not wrong. I just say what I mean is greed, kind of. When you see Dublin there, you understand that there's a cohort of people who are home and hoes. If you're talking about Dublin based south, there's a reason why there's a lot of reasonable, you know, there's people there who are ABC ones, as they refer to them in the economic scale, and that's where that core vote is. Everybody outside of that is thinking. But I think also Sinn Féin aren't actually their actual biggest selling point is they're not Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it's literally, I don't think people are rewarding them because Eoin Óibrín has the better housing policies than Dara O'Brien and Noel Murphy did. They are to a degree, but I think they're also rewarding them on the basis of, well, we can't put up with these fuckers for much longer.
I think you're 100% right, Tony, on that. And I think people voted for change the last election and they haven't got it.
Yeah, but I put it to you, Martin, that it was a lucky thing for Sinn Féin that it didn't have the numbers the last time. Now,
I don't think they'll make the same mistake twice. I'll just say that. I don't think that they will.
I know, but what I mean is they've got people now who will have 4 years under their belts in the Dáil as TDs in opposition that needed that. So maybe they won't have, like, because the last election, it was kind of Sinn Féin had, you know, Owen, Pearce, Matt, you know, Mary Lou. You can name, like, on one hand, they're kind of, they're 5-on-5 and say that's who they're running.
I think what's more important is that the public can name on one hand five elected Sinn Féin TDs, but can they name five Fianna Fáil TDs? There's a question. Could anybody name five Fianna Fáil TDs?
Quite easily, but Mark McSherry wants them all to leave the party.
The other story of the poll is the Greens, and the Greens have absolutely shot themselves in the foot. They are now Labour, whatever, reborn, reincarnated.
It's one poll, and they're doing okay in Dublin again.
It's a trend, Tony. It's a trend. If it was just one poll, you'd say it's just one poll, but it's not. It's a trend.
I'm looking forward to when we get a new Green Party, because we don't have to have just one, and we get a radical party, because a lot of the young idealistic people that are radicals and that are, but it being Pride Month, particularly those that are queer and LGBTQA or quiltback, left the Greens. And I think they were right to. And I'm looking forward to when we have a proper left-leaning radical Green.
Well, they're off to a reasonable start with the new eco-socialist movement. They've done some good stuff in terms of the people there, and like Lorna Bogue is very much, like, she's a very smart young woman who knows what she's on about, and like she intimidates me all the time, so that's obviously a really good sign. I think that's right, Jan, but I do think there's space there for that. But I do think I wouldn't be panicking about one poll, but what I would say is Sinn Féin, or if you put it through a longer prism, 2019 similar poll, Sinn Féin, I think we're at about 20%. They're now at 34. Fine Gael, we're at 32%, and are now at 24.
So positions have swapped, Tony.
Yeah. So that is that, and that's not one poll, as Martin just points out. That's actually through the prism of a few years now. And if you look it over at that's a hard trend to book if you're in any way, shape, or form.
The other thing is that the for want of a better word, we'll call the centrist Fianna Fáil Fine Gael vote has been dropping election on election. But Fine Gael is now dropping faster than Fianna Fáil, at twice the rate of Fianna Fáil. If that trend continues, the idea that Fine Gael is the second party is gone out the window. Fianna Fáil is back as the second party if that trend. One more poll.
I don't think it's the poll. Not in a million years. I think it's them shooting themselves in the foot. I think it is very much giving out about the splinter in their brother's eye and not looking at the log in their own, from the biblical quote, because they keep saying, oh, look, Sinn Féin did this thing. And then it comes out, they did it. They did it more. They did it worse. They lied about it.
Actually, we did want to talk. We did want to talk about that. That was quite funny.
Not an ordinary party. And then, well, actually, yeah, just like everybody else.
They had a go at the websites. They had a go at where they had their polling data. They had a go at how they take those polls. And I don't know what idiot is coming up with this and thinking it's a good idea, because all they're doing is pissing people off and going, you know what? I might vote Sinn Féin, which for me, who grew up not hearing Gerry Adams' voice because he was a very dangerous man, that we might have Sinn Féin in government is quite a head twist. You know, I got to get my head around it. But they're not interested in sorting out the cuts to welfare. They're not interested in sorting out the SNAs. They're not interested in sorting out Covert 7. They're not interested in sorting homelessness and child poverty. You know, we're not interested in redressing the institutional abuse. No, let's give about how other people are getting and holding their data about voters. Let's do that petty stuff. Let's have us talking about it. Let's have the media talking about it. And let's hold them really accountable to the things which need to change in this country. That's why that makes me angry. That's why I never laugh at it, because that's what they want. They want you talking about points and polls and who's doing well and who's up and, oh no, quaking in their boots. No, I'm sorry. I want them quaking in their boots, the fact that we have the high levels of child poverty. We have the high level of homelessness. This week had another homeless person die on our streets. Why isn't that what we're talking about? Why are we getting caught in their spin? Because frankly, feck that.
Jan, if I could give you this mic to drop, I certainly I would. I'd give it to you to drop. I would.
And of course, while Sinn Féin, we're looking at this poll, also a huge week for them coming up in the north, in terms of what's going to happen around, you know, are they going to go back into government? Are they going to support the new assembly? under the new leadership and under the new First Minister, are, you know, are they going to hold firm on their position on the Irish Language Act? And might we see a collapse of the Stormont Assembly again? And what is that going to do to the people of Northern Ireland who've been through so much in terms of a collapsed assembly before? And, you know, and what will the impact be down here with Micheál Martin having met some of them in the last week? So really significant week ahead for Sinn Féin in the North as well.
And will Sinn Féin sit in their hands in regards to the fact that they say they're an all-Ireland party and that all of their policies are across the entire 32 counties, except for maybe abortion rights and abortion access?
Yeah.
We've had that comment. We've put that to Mary Lou MacDonald on this podcast, and she also tried to hit it with a bat, and I don't think it was a straight one at the time, Jan. It didn't land. Just on, actually though, we are scheduled to talk to the Lord Mayor of Belfast, Kate Nicholl, from the Alliance Party on Friday. So that should be an interesting time, Vicky, in terms of how timing couldn't be better, you know.
Tony, you said to me you had some news you wanted to share.
It was more kind of what I'm trying to watch this. There's a lot of coming on. This week is the week for housing, by the way. Fianna Fáil are back in, and I think it's Thursday. And the minister is going in to produce his LDA bill. This is going through all the phases, and it's going to be put through. Funnily enough, he's actually also, you guys will hear this now, he's in our diary for Thursday at 11 o'clock for record a podcast on the same day. There's a lot going on in terms of housing. We will be looking at it in more detail over the week. There's a comment about the Meagher address. Yes, we're actually recording a podcast on it tomorrow at 12:30.
They could sort out the Mike and Meagher stuff when it was in the financial centre, but not people's homes.
And it's really surreal because I moved up to Inishowen last week. And it is like everywhere. You can't move 100 meters without the signs naming the company involved, how they ruined our lives, how 100% redress or anything. It's very in your face here.
Isn't the state really, really lucky we don't have class action here? Because class action in regards to the institutional abuse, Micheál and all the rest of us.
Well, we do have 8 judicial reviews underway of the commission report, and that's the equivalent of a class action.
And I do really have to correct you. They do use class decisions when it suits them too.
Yeah,
not for citizens against the state, unfortunately.
There's a lot, actually. Just one other thing, I know I'm going to bore you guys with the economics, but we had Eric Lonergan on. He spoke about the difference between what Joe Biden was doing and what the EU, the ECB were doing, and he outlined, you know, how it should be done. But it's hit a snag in the US with a couple of lads not playing ball for their own side. So that's going to be interesting in terms of from a global perspective. We actually need stimulus now, is my opinion. And we will be going back to it now. Eric has sent me a couple of details for some of the guys who wrote a few papers to the ECB on how they should use stimulus. So hopefully talk to them in the next few days. That's basically... Oh, Vicky, you've a pod coming this week as well, don't you?
Yeah, this week we're talking to Neil Fox, whose sister Donna died having been knocked down by a truck in Dublin City Centre. And it builds on what we talked about this week around the treatment of cyclists by policing. And we really see how that plays out at the hard end. And I did just want to flag as well the news today that... two guards in Dublin City Centre have been suspended because a 17-year-old suffered a bleed on the brain following an arrest. You know, we talk about Terence Wheelock and there's commemorations for him coming up later this month. Please do follow them and support his family. They are holding events to kind of pursue their quest for an inquiry into what happened to Terence. But, you know, this is still happening. A bleed on the brain, how severely he was beaten. We think this can't happen anymore, but clearly it can. And it's really concerning. And it will be referred to GSOC. We know how that goes. We also have the inquest for George and Kencho coming up in 9 days' time. And there is a vigil being planned. Ruth Coppinger is involved in that. I had a lengthy conversation with her about this week, and they could also use support. So really, you know, it's just really alarming. I think a lot of people think police brutality isn't an issue in this state, but there is a real concern and a lot of questions to be asked during this.
Sorry, Jan, did you want to say something?
Just to let people know that the repeal review is due this year. This is the legislation which was put in place after we repealed the 8th. This legislation is restrictive, and we have the data from the NHS showing that over 500 women and girls and pregnant people travelled from the island of Ireland during a pandemic to access abortion care. We do not have care at home. An awful lot of these were people who were dealing with fetal abnormalities and gross abnormalities. So all of the women and the couples from terminations for medical reasons who shared their pain and their heart, their stories and their trauma, people in those circumstances are still having to travel because the law is too vague. It doesn't give cover to the consultants. It doesn't give cover then to the insurance firms. So the consultants are having their hands doubly tied. And none of them are brave enough to risk their career and their medical license to give these people the care they need at home. And we've also had the case where we only legislated for the abortion pills. We did not legislate for surgical abortion. That is suction abortion here at all. So if you, due to underlying medical conditions, cannot use the abortion pills, you have no option but to travel, and the HSE won't pay for it. If you are one of the very, very rare cases where you do use the abortion pills and they fail to work, and then you're outside of the 12 weeks, you are going to have to travel and pay for it. And the HSE will not help you with that. If you're somebody who doesn't find out until it's too late, or you have a doctor who is anti-abortion, a GP, who delays your care and you don't get to use the abortion pills, or you it's a serious issue, or you're someone living in cramped, crowded conditions, because the abortion pills are not an easy thing to take. They are 24 hours plus of cramping, bleeding, possibly diarrhea. It is not a pleasant experience. It is quite can be quite traumatic on the body, and you need somewhere that is safe to do that. If you're in a relationship which is abusive and coercive, trying to take the abortion pills just isn't an option. So we don't offer surgical abortion here. We don't look after people who fall outside of the 12-week limits. They're only offering the pills. They don't look after people who are dealing with fetal abnormality. They're not looking properly after people who might need a termination because of risk to health, because they have left the law too vague. So people are not being looked after. We fought to repeal the 8. We fought for care at home, for services at home. We haven't got them. So we need to hold people accountable. We also have not had the legislation. Simon Harris promised that we would get rid of rogue pregnancy clinics. Gynecare is still going. Gynecare is still duping people into how pregnant they are and ruining their choices to get an abortion here in Ireland.
You've got the issues really succinctly there, and the review, there's no clarity as to how that's going to be undertaken at all. So it's something we'll be watching on the shock, absolutely. And we'll quite probably talk to you again about that, Jan.
I'm just going to plug lastly, the abortion rights campaign are still working. You can still, we've always done remote working. I always did remote working with them. I'm not active at the moment, but they're looking for people. They're also looking for donations. Also, the Abortion Support Network are the people who organise to get people from here to the UK for when they need a termination. And the cost has gone up dramatically, as you can imagine, during a pandemic. So if you can, after you subscribe to the Patreon for the Tortoise Shack, throw a fiver to the Abortion Support Network, please.
Oh God, you couldn't have made Tony any happier there.
I said Jan's a legend. What can I tell you? Sorry.
Tomás and Jan, that's been like a really, really fantastic discussion today. Jan, we've covered so many different issues with you. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. And thank you again, Tomás, for your expert opinion, as always. If you're listening back to this, please do subscribe at Tortoiseshack, patreon.com/Tortoiseshack. And we'll open it up now for those who've been around. Get your questions in, throw your hands up, and we'll have a good conversation. Thanks so much.